This is the Mobile Home Park Lawyer Podcast with Fur Neiman. If you're looking to generate wealth and passive income in the lucrative world of mobile home parks, you're in the right place. You'll discover solutions to the common legal and operational pitfalls and how to optimize parks to maximize income. Your host is in the trenches. He's a real estate attorney, financial analyst, and mobile home park investor and operator. Now, let's turn it over to Fur Neiman.
Welcome back, Mobile Home Park Nation. Fur Neiman here again today with another episode of the Mobile Home Park Lawyer Podcast. Got another great guest for you today. He's an appraiser, which is near and dear to my heart because I love arguing with appraisers. No, I love working with appraisers, and I used to be Jackson County appraiser here in Kansas City, Missouri. So I got a little background in this. It's nice to talk to somebody who's got even more background and more experience. So please help me welcome my guest, Chuck Sherbeck. Chuck, thanks for coming on, man.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate you having me on.
So. Yeah, well, I know you a little bit and I follow your newsletter, which is full of good information. So we can tell people about that as well, how to find you and all that here before we jump. But maybe tell us a little bit more about your background, how you got into the business and what you do today.
Yeah, so I started in as an appraiser in 2001, and I actually started off as a, I started off with senior housing. The guy I first worked under did nursing homes, assisted living, CCRCs, stuff like that. Did that for a couple of years, and then I switched over to work under Bruce Nell, who's the current head of our practice group. I've known Bruce since the seventh grade. So wow. We sort of grew up together. I went to college at Ohio State and was actually a religious studies major. My plan was eventually go on to grad school, but I got married a few days after graduating and I never got back. Bruce had started working as an appraiser. And so I connected with him and just started doing appraisers with another guy that was actually a member of our church. So that's kind of how I got into it. When I switched under Bruce, he was developing a strong manufactured housing practice. And so from about 2006 on, through the recession and all that, we started, became a specialist in it. And Bruce rose up through the ranks. And so he's actually the largest producer for appraisal reports. He brings in the work. He's really good at selling it. So I'm currently the head of manufactured housing for the Midwest and Northeast. But we have our whole team is nationwide coverage. We have someone that works out the Pacific Northwest. We've got two people in California. We've got a couple people in Texas, someone in Florida that covers the Southeast. We got someone in Nashville that covers the other half of the South. So we've got this, what I think is one of the stronger groups for appraisals in the industry, because most of our regional heads are MAIs, which is highest designation you get as an appraiser. I'm an MAI myself. So, we started a different area, but switched over to MH, and along with Bruce, we've built a pretty strong national team.
So. Yeah, no, I see you guys are active. I see you on LinkedIn and other places. You're always doing a ton of deals. So maybe tell us right now for our listeners, it's March of 24. So we're in a pretty unique interest rate environment, at least relative to the last few years where interest rates have gone up. How is that impacting in your business and your clients' business as far as transaction volume? And how I've always kind of heard and followed that cap rates tend to have a lag behind interest rates. So if interest rates are up 250 bips, do cap rates go up 250 or they go less for certain assets? How's that all
so how's that work today? There's a couple of like counterbalancing forces. Interest rates have sort of tamped down things a little bit, and even cap rates have gone up over the past couple of years. So, that's a pushes down value. But the other thing is that, you know, since, well, I mean, it goes back before the pandemic, but I think a lot of people in the pandemic realized, all right, the people own the homes. So of all your renters out there, the people that are most likely to continue paying rent are those people that are invested in the real estate in some sense. So, you know, even you look at that against other things that were considered locks in real estate, like, you know, triple net retail and things like that, that had suffered during the pandemic as well. There was what was a heightened interest, it even increased. So after the pandemic for the next couple of years, you had a lot of people getting into the, a lot of people getting into the industry. So all that money and interest has sort of pushed down cap rates. We'd be even, you know, I'd say up until early 2022, you know, every few months I would say there's no way cap rates can get any lower. I mean, it's insane. So there's, in that sense, you know, manufactured housing is beating the average. But certainly things are, you know, cap rates are higher, values are lower than what they were year and a half ago, even.
So what I've kind of seen, tell me if you disagree, but I mean, you look at it, a lot of markets yourself, but what I've seen is interest rates have gone up by, you know, a sizable margin, but for manufactured housing, because of the stickiness of the tenant base, because some of the underlying fundamentals, the asset class, cap rates have gone up some, but not as much as interest rates and not as much as some of the other asset classes. Is that a fair assessment?
100%. That's right.
Okay. So great. Now, you made a comment a minute ago, and I think we've all made this comment that, you know, man, can cap rates get any lower? Or they're kind of insane. But obviously, if a willing buyer and a willing seller transact at that price, you know, that is the market. How much do you look at market comps versus, you know, your own other analysis or opinion? And how does that change from time to time, if at all?
Well, yeah, I mean, so there's several different ways we look at cap rates, developing them. One is market comps, and that is overwhelmingly, like you said, I mean, the definition of market value is a knowledgeable buyer and knowledgeable selling come together. You know, that's the strongest support. We will also call around to brokers. You know, if you're subscribed to the newsletter, you know, I put out a weekly rundown of what's listing in the market. So we look at current listings. That's an important factor. There's financing techniques. There's band of investment and debt coverage ratio techniques that are get there. Now those are kind of diverging from some of the other sources because of the factors we already discussed. But those are the things, and the market comps are the number one thing that we look at. So.
So how has the market changed as far as, I mean, what percentage is volume down, if you have that statistic, or days on market? I mean, I know I recently saw a deal that I thought was overpriced by a ton. I'm like, this is overpriced even at the peak of the market. And apparently it was, because I offered like 70 cents on the dollar. And I was like, this is a lowball offer. And the broker got back to me and said, you're our selected buyer, but then they wanted me to go another $2 million. I was like, well, I'm not going to do that. But they told me that nobody else, you know, at least no credible buyer made a bigger number than me. And I was 70% of the list. So that, I don't know if it's going to transact or not. My gut is no, cause we're so far apart, but there's seemingly is still a disconnect where sellers want yesterday's prices, but buyers can't get yesterday's loans. So they can't, you can't pay the same price you could a year and a half ago.
Right. Yeah. No, the, sorry, what was, can you restate that question?
What are you seeing on transaction volume?
Oh yeah.
In particular.
So yeah, I would say, you know, early 2022. I think when we started towards the end of 2022 on into 23, we sort of stopped looking at sales older than June or July of that year. Anything before that, we just sort of put aside because we wanted to see what was going on. You know, prior early, you know, pandemic to 2020, early 2022, it was 3 months or less was sort of our marketing period for these things. Okay. And I would call brokers and say, you know, I've not done my job if it's all the way up to 3 months. I think you're getting to, we're putting more like 6 to 9 months for that sort of time period. So it's certainly, there's a disconnect to a certain extent between buyer and seller expectations. So, and it, you know, that's, it certainly slowed down things. I did, you know, I was, there was a point in 2021 and 22 where I was doing, I was averaging 10 to 20 appraisals a month, and now I'm 5 to 10. So it's,
got it.
In terms of that factor, it's, my business is half of what it used to be. So.
Yeah, that's, I see it a lot in the market too. I mean, the same thing with a lot of our law clients, like guys that are really active. I'm like, I haven't heard from you in 6 months. Did you replace me? He's like, no, we're just on the sidelines. Like, okay, I was going to make sure. Let's talk about variables that impact value. So I'm going to give you a hypothetical park. We were talking earlier, okay. you appraised one of my parks in the past in Quincy, Illinois, my hometown. So let's assume, just pick one, you know, 50, I sold this park, so we'll pick this one, 54 sites in Western Illinois, city water, city sewer, mostly tenant-owned homes, so let's say 90 to 95% tenant-owned homes. What kind of cap rate, let's, you know, three-star park, you know, decent park, paved roads, you know, mostly single wides, but, you know, 80s and newer, 80s, 90s, so, you know, vinyl siding, shingle roof. What kind of cap rate does that look like in today's market? And then I'm curious to see what that would look like, you know, in the past, what you think it'll look like in the future. And then from there, we'll look at variables such as modifying utilities and occupancy and so on.
Yeah. So I'll pull up something here real quick. I put together I put together a newsletter that we're going to hand out at the manufactured housing event next week. And I kind of put together where we see cap rates coming in at. So these are, you know, we sort of break stuff into sort of quality classification. So 4 to 5 star class A properties. They also tend to be larger communities. You know, you're probably looking at on stuff like that, you could look at 4.5 and under. You know, maybe getting down even under 4 in some really nice markets like Florida, California, stuff like that. You know, class B properties, you're probably looking at somewhere between 5 and 6.5. Some of the, you know, if it's in a major city, if it's a, you know, how many home sites it is, is a factor. The potential of the market is a factor. You know, occupancy, upside is, I guess, the best way to put it. Occupancy potential increase, rents potential increase. Those are probably.
So you'll give a lower cap rate and thus a higher value if there's upside in the rents and the occupancy as opposed to going off current NOI?
So It depends who we're doing it for. So Fannie and Freddie, which is who I do a lot of stuff for, they will not let you look at, you know, leasing up the property and taking off the cost to lease it up. That's one way we would approach it. So if you're looking at that, the only way you can really quantify that upside is by putting it in the cap rate. And then when you get to Class C, and you know, for us, Class B is probably the largest classification. You know, it's 3 to 4 star. Anything under a 3 star property we consider Class C, and those would be, you know, they might kind of merge into Class B range if they were in a really nice area, but other than that, you're probably looking at, you know, 6.5 all the way up to 12 if it's a bad location, old homes, stuff like that.
Okay, now what if it's a nice, like I have one park in particular, it's a nice park, nice market, but I have private sewer, I've got septic. Are you going to decrease my value a little based on private utilities? Or are you going to just have if that expense is already included in the operating expense, are you going to not ding me?
I may not necessarily reduce for that. And that's because it's a consideration, you know. I think a lot of owners have figured out how to deal with that. Right. It's you know, you want to do your due diligence and make sure that your septic system is operating properly. But if it's in good shape, you know, it would be a bigger draw or a bigger, you know, downtick if it was, you know, 5 to 10 years ago. I mean, but I think most major owner operators have figured out how to work that in. I mean, if it's not, you know, on city water sewer, is that because it's way out in the country and it's hard to get to? That then gets into more of the overall quality of the community. But if it's a nice community and it just happens to have septic or well water, as long as there are no, as long as in working order and there's no environmental concerns.
Got it.
But on a, you know, that's sort of a case by case basis we got to figure out. I've seen some crazy environmental issues on some properties.
I bet. Yeah, those can get pretty gnarly. Now tell me about the, you know, home site count. What are the, I know for like Fannie Mae, typically 50 sites is a kind of a magic number for that quality of financing. Is a 49 site park only one worse than 50, or is it basically like 5 worse or 10 because it doesn't hit the 50? And then are there other metrics beyond, you know, say 50 or say 100? Is a 39 site park basically the same as 40, or is it, you know, where are those breakpoints?
You know, you do get below certain breakpoints where your where there is a downtick, but I don't think necessarily part of the problem for me is that most of what I do is Fannie and Freddie, so I'm not necessarily seeing those smaller communities. Although I do see them when I do a couple of year-end valuations from larger owner operators, and they'll have one or two, one of the owners I work with, Kurt Keeney, he calls them pocket parks. Mm-hmm. These little tiny little things that he usually acquires as part of, you know, he's buying, he bought like a 200 site in southwest Louisville, and he got 5 pocket parks with it. So I think, you know, oftentimes I'll see those, I'll see somebody buy, you know, 225 siders that are close to each other and run them as one property.
Sure.
And that mitigates that factor. But yeah, no, I if you've got a A 10 cider. It's that's certainly less than that. That's less desirable than a 50 cider. The smaller you get, the more it's not a national owner operator dealing with it. And then there becomes a variety of factors, the cost and upkeep, and you sort of lose some of the economies and scales that you get with larger communities. And the smaller you get, I don't know a specific price point, but certainly 10 is not as good as a 40. So
right, and on a part of that economy scales, it's hard. You've got a 10 site park. It's hard to hire a manager, right?
Right.
You can't afford a good manager, or at least not a high paid manager. So I mean, tell me, what do you see on expense ratios? I've had numbers float around for years. And then, I know Frank Roth's bootcamp, he used to say, it's 30% if the tenants are paying the water sewer, it's 40. And obviously that number, if the water's free, but that ratio is going to be different if it's 10 sites versus 110 sites. And obviously your tax burden and, a number of, your top line rent and all that impacts. I'm just curious, what do you see in the ranges? I had one park, for example, I sold, they had 22% expense ratio, and the broker listed it told me, no one's going to believe that. We're going to underwrite it at 35. And that really hurt the value. I'm like, but it really does have 22. They could, I'm telling the truth. So they basically underwrote it at 30. That's the best they would give me, even though it was, for the listing at least, even though it really was 22. So how do you look at that? And what's your experience with that?
Well, yeah. So, you know, 22 is not, it does not surprise me. I've seen a lot in that range, the 20 to, 35, which would be considered lighter, but, I would say, and I actually have some numbers here, the data we have on Class A properties, and this is mostly in the Midwest, is actually 26% as an average. Class B, the average, Class B and C are the same in the data I have at 34%. So typically, the typical range of what we're seeing is probably that, I know some owners that run pretty light, and I know some owners that run pretty heavy. Different philosophies in different parts. There's some people that will, insurance is one area. I got one client that'll insure electric lines running into a community. And then I know one owner who will tear down a clubhouse and put a double wide in as a clubhouse. Better call it a multi-section. It's not like an old, it's a decent, it looks as nice as any clubhouse, but he didn't have to insure it. So it's just different philosophies. And then all of a sudden you're going low on that. A lot of people, it's one same owner has in one community, they use, they have their own personal, they have their maintenance people go around and collect the trash and then put it in their dumpsters, and that saves them a considerable amount. So you can get pretty tight on these things. I would have the expense comps to prove your rates, which is, we mentioned this earlier. It's a reason to go with an expert and, in manufactured housing, because we've seen almost every scenario, right? In those smaller communities, on-site management may be just one of the residents. Everybody's responsible for taking care of maintaining their site, and you just pay an on-site manager to collect rents, and you're just paying them you're just paying them free rent, right? They're that's their, and so it's the rent of a property times 12 and a rent of a site times 12, and that's your expense. I did one community in Buffalo, New York, where it was a 55 plus community, all multi-section homes, you know, almost class A, and that they didn't have any common areas to maintain though. I mean, everybody was just happy to have a really nice home with an affordable site rent. And, you know, I met everybody in the owner of this multi-section that was this, you know, 75-year-old lady that was sweet as could be. And she was the manager of the community, and all she did is collect rents and or collect checks. And, you know, so you, yeah, they were decent rents. I mean, it was, the expense ratio was very low because you didn't have any, you had very low management. So very low maintenance too. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, it's, a part of it's just being able to tell the story of why stuff is that low and having the data to back it up.
Okay. Makes sense. Let me ask you about park-owned homes. How do you value those? And do you put a different expense ratio on them, different cap rate? Do you capitalize the NOI, or do you look at shell values?
So in terms of park-owned homes,
we
don't typically value them directly. We will sometimes evaluate the impact they have overall in the community. Although, you know, when I was starting out, people were very reticent to have a lot of community owned homes because you didn't have that factor I mentioned earlier where people are invested, right? And so that was a concern, but it's a lot less of a concern anymore. You've got major owner operators whose model is to bring in a bunch of homes and rent the homes in sight. Most lenders won't lend on it. When they do, we value them, and we just sort of look at them a variety of ways. One, you know, there's a variety of cost sorts, reports. There's NADA, which I've used before. I've got Marshall and Swift, which is another valuation source. It's less accurate, but, you know, if, you know, sometimes it's not as important to be, you know, down to the dollar on what the house is worth, and the client, and it's not a value issue. You know, I'll use Marshall and Swift. So those are a couple of just cost approach ways. Sometimes we will include it in the regular, you know, we'll put it in as the homes and the expenses as a line item. And then what we'll do is we'll try and determine the difference between the cap rate on the homes versus the home sites. And that can range anywhere from 5 basis points or 500 basis points to 0 basis points. And the key difference is Wells Fargo had a program, and they've not called us to do any more work on it. So I don't know if they're still doing it or not, but they had a program where they would value everything, and we use the same cap rate. The difference is that they were able to get the homes classified as real estate. There's a part of the tax code that we used that defines whether or not you can count for a tax deduction a manufactured home as real estate or personal property, which impacts how you can deal with it from a tax standpoint. So we use that classification to say this is real estate because it meets these criteria. And the funny thing, it, you know, upon reading it, it was like most of the home sites that I'm familiar, or homes that I'm familiar with, are sited in this manner. So like, you can make an argument that most home sites are real estate. But not a lot of people do. And then we, you know, when we were doing it that way, I think we, there was a difference between order new homes. I think it was just in the rent. I just think that that was, we still use the same cap rate. But typically, you know, we're probably closer to the, you know, 3 to 5% increase over the going in rate, or going over the real estate cap rate. And then what we do is we take the percentage of the income stream that each is, and we multiply that by the cap rate, and then sort of get a weighted average. So that's one way we do it. And then another is we just isolate, you know, we throw in the addendum, here's the value of the community owned homes, here's the income and expenses, and here's the cap rate we're using. But it's a higher cap rate, because if we're viewing it as personal property versus real estate, then there's a lot more risk to that, if that makes sense.
Okay, makes sense. Now, let me ask you this. What mistakes do you see buyers make? Anything come to mind with that, you know, a buyer's valuing something at X, and then you get involved and you're like, no, it's really only 0.7x, and you're upside down. Anything that the buyers in the marketplace tend to make mistake on, or buyers pretty savvy, and generally have a similar valuation that you have?
You know, the buyers that we're working with are generally pretty savvy in terms of how they're evaluating things, more so than you know, mom and pop owner operators that have had the property for a while. I, you know, the mistake I would see from, you know, maybe a small owner operator that's not as active in the market is that they're, you know, they're not increasing rents as much as they should. They're not, you know, some smaller owner operators are probably operating at 70% or below occupancy, because they just have not taken the time to figure out how to bring in homes and sell them. So, you know, mistakes that a buyer could come in and make, you know, times when we've seen, times that we've seen things, even experienced buyers, I would say is, you know, if you've got an equity partner that you're working with, and that equity partner is unwilling to, I guess finding the right equity partner, if that's the situation that you're in, is important. If you're buying something for upside, you've got to have the ability to buy homes and bring them in. I mean, you got to increase occupancy. Another concern is, you know, is the area you're going into actually an area where you can increase occupancy? So are you buying something where, you know, I've had people talk about, there's one property up in Flint, Michigan that I've appraised multiple times, and each time, you know, and this is like over the course of a decade, each time somebody was convinced they were going to bring in homes and lease it up, and each time I go back to appraise it again, it is the same occupancy. And I don't, come to think of this particular property, I don't remember going back and seeing, you know, new homes, right? Like it's still the homes that were there. So I'm not always privy to what the breakdown was. But I know some major owner operators where they're looking at different equity partners because they want someone that can partner with them to bring in homes. And that's, I mean, you got to be able to bring in homes and finance them if you're going to capitalize on the upside. So that should be a consideration going in.
Yeah, I know you mentioned earlier there's some big operators doing the park-owned home model. So that being the more of the new wave, is there much difference in value or cap rate if I've got a 50 site park with 40 park owned homes versus zero park owned homes. Is are those the same nowadays? Where I feel like in the past, the park owned homes were seen as a liability a little bit.
The park owned homes have been seen as a liability, and you know, I think you know, larger owner operators, even Reach like ELS and Sun. I mean, they're getting to, I don't know the exact amount, but I've understood that they've gotten up to, you know, 25% park owned home in some of their communities. I don't think they're doing 100%. And I think the strategy generally with people starting, I think people are starting off with community owned homes and then they're phasing them. They're trying to get the people to become buyers. Sure. But if you've got a 50% occupied community, I think bringing in a bunch of community owned homes and or a bunch of homes and renting them, it's kind of a way to kind of prime the pump on getting that community leased up, and then you can deal with switching it over. But I mean, there's still a lot of reluctance in the industry from people on those sort of communities. But it's part of it's the market you're in. So like, you know, I mentioned Flint earlier. Flint is a sorry for the noise, something going on the street. The Flint's a rental market. Houston, Texas is a rental market versus Dallas, which is a buyer's market, right? So stuff like that, those areas, you know, we have a team in Houston, so, but, you know, a decade ago when I was, I did a couple of communities in Houston, and they were super nice communities, but they were rental. We're seeing more of that. You know, there's a developer that I was made aware of in West Virginia that wants to do it's essentially you know, the build to rent phenomena, I think, is coming along stronger, and I think because of that, a couple of people are wanting to do that, but with manufactured housing. So that's, I think, just kind of a different perspective or way of doing things. I don't necessarily know that it's going to, if you're just valuing the home sites, if you've got a bunch of new homes in there and you got the right operator, I wouldn't necessarily ding the value, and I haven't. You know, Cambio is the one that I know that's had a strong rental program, and their previous company sold to Sun. I think it was to Sun or Yes. I can't remember right now. It sold at the same cap rate as something that wasn't that heavily rentals. Right. So, yeah. Yeah. And that's another factor in value too, is, you know, there's been a couple of large portfolios that have traded over the past couple of years. And those are, if you're looking at those for comps, they're almost different rules, because there's a lot of people that want to like jump into the industry with both feet, and they will pay lower cap rates to get portfolios.
Right. There's certainly a portfolio premium. You get it, jump in with significant scale. I mean,
yeah,
at least 1,000 sites, but some of these guys are buying 10,000 at a time. You know, it's unbelievable.
Yeah. No, you're aware of the Moore portfolio that recently traded.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think they just closed on it. The Crow Properties ended up putting a press release out.
Crow Properties, I saw last week, bought 10,000 or so sites. Are they the ones that bought the Moore portfolio?
That Well, yeah, no, it's the same number of properties in the same states. So
Okay.
it's 46 properties. There's not that many 46 property portfolios in that same set of states. So that's got to be that transaction. I don't have 100% confirmation, but I'm pretty certain
Okay.
that that's
Yeah, big
the
number.
buyer.
All right, Chuck. Well, we've got a couple minutes left. Anything else you want to share? Any tips or tricks for our audience? Or if not, where can people find you?
No, so if anybody's going to MHI, our booth number is going to be 200. Feel free to stop by. You can find me on LinkedIn. I'm happy to connect with, or just search. It's Chuck Scherbeck, last name Scherbeck. You can find my I put a daily newsletter out, different topics each day. You can find that at realestatesolutionist.substack.com. And my two popular posts are Tuesday and Wednesday. Tuesday, I put out MHC listings. I go out to all the brokers and put a listing of their sales. I do the same thing on Wednesday, but with RV. So yeah, be happy if anybody to check that out. That's how to connect with me.
All right. Sounds good, Chuck. Well, I hope to see you in person next week. And thanks for coming on the show.
Okay, thank you.
Got it.
You've been listening to the Mobile Home Park Lawyer Podcast with Ferd Nieman. Ready to learn more? Go to www.themobilehomelawyer.com for free resources and materials to help you succeed. If you love the podcast, go to Apple Podcasts, give us your review, and subscribe today. Thank you for listening. Neither the Supreme Court of Missouri nor the Missouri Bar reviews nor approves certifying organizations or specialist designations. The choice of a lawyer is an important decision and should not be based solely upon advertisements.